I've been seeing Jonathan Kay's tweets in my timeline a lot lately, just people interacting with them, signal boosting them, screenshotting them. I see Conrad Black's tweets all the time as well. I see them a lot this week because in Canada, there was an investigation into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, which has been a very serious issue in Canada. And the ruling this week declared it a genocide. And of course, our very serious pundit class has been taking issue with the use of the word genocide. And it was a reminder to me yet again about how Canada just per capita produces more and worse public figures and public intellectuals than any other developed nation.
It's extraordinary. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked a lot about the American press and recent episode, the British media, and how right-wing it is. I think even many Canadians underestimate how right-wing our press is. Post Media, which was founded to be, you know, a voice for the quote-unquote intellectual right, now owns, you know, a great many of the newspapers. The Globe and Mail, which is kind of the paper of record, I mean, it is a paper of the, you know, pro-business center right.
And the Toronto Star, which is our liberal daily, but it's also one that always finds a way to endorse John Tory for mayor.
Right, right. I mean, it's not, I mean, it's hardly a left-wing newspaper. And I mean, the kinds of things that are printable in the Canadian media, I mean, these right-wing figures that the, you know, Canadian media churns out, I mean, their whole philosophy is premised on the idea that they're constantly being silenced, that there are these buried truths that they're not allowed to express. I would just test that thesis by looking at any of the right-wing newspapers in this country and seeing what is considered, you know, perfectly respectable mainstream opinion that you can put in a daily paper. At my old job, I spent a lot of time, you know, kind of following along with and reporting on the conservative movement in this country. Conservative movement has people that get printed in major newspapers talking about how the residential school system, which was described by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a kind of public inquiry into the residential schools as cultural genocide, how actually they were not as bad as you think, and actually they had some kind of civilizing effects. That is a thing that you can read in Canadian newspapers. You can read editorials about how feminism is a cancer. The Conservative Party, many sitting members of the Conservative Party have ties to, you know, far right figures who now exist in the worst corners of the internet. This is all just, you know, out in the open. Yet some people continue to believe that Canada is this kind of bastion of pluralism. Both on the right and the sort of nominal left believe that, you know, multiculturalism is kind of impregnable here and it can't happen here, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I wish that were so.
Certain of our journalists and columnists do paid speeches for oil companies. but if you have a columnist who is at all active with, say, Black Lives Matter,
a big no-no.
They get their column taken away because they've influenced the news.
That's right.
And, you know, when you see somebody like John Kay or Conrad Black, there's a tragedy there. Because not only are they awful, but there's a very distinctly Canadian texture to their awfulness.
Yeah.
It's like when you see a movie and it's supposed to be set in New York, but it's shot in Toronto, and you can tell that it's shot in Toronto. It just has this vibe about it. They're as odious in their views as their American equivalents, but because they've been in a system that doesn't require any success to get ahead, they're simply there because of their sort of class status.
Well, for American listeners, imagine any mutant from the National Review or the Federalist, but provincial.
Yeah.
More provincial. And that's, you've just imagined the Canadian right-wing public intellectual.
Yeah. And they get foisted on us because the media ecosystem is smaller here. Like, there are lots of people who only write for the National Review. And if you don't read that publication, you wouldn't know who they are.
But here, there's only three newspapers. Yeah.
So everybody knows who Conrad Black is. And yet he has no public support. You know, he has no fans. Nobody likes him. He has no charisma. He has nothing to say. There's a reason that he's only famous here.
Will, what are you talking about? I was at Indigo the other day, and his name is emblazoned on the wall, along with, you know, some of our great literary figures.
Yeah, like Alanis Morissette and Mike Bullard.
Mike Myers. Everybody's read his History of Canada, right?
Oh, yeah. Some doorstop called, like, a Destiny to Greatness. You know, how we became the leading... This guy who...
How colony became nation.
This man who renounced his Canadian citizenship because he's so horny to be another country. So he just wanted to become a British lord.
I can't go into this too much, but I did catch Conrad Black making illegal foreign donations and reported on it in the past. If you search Press Progress Conrad Black, you can read about that. He ended up having to return the money to both the Liberal and Conservative parties that he had illegally donated.
I don't know. I think you're slandering him because he, as of recently, has a very clean criminal record. I like whenever Conrad Black talks about Trump because he talks about him in that kind of like noble, savage way. It's like, yes, I'm deigning to talk about Donald Trump.
But he likes Trump.
And like Donald Trump, people like him and Doug Ford are sort of beneath me, but because they're beneath me, they're pure in some way. You know that posture?
Conrad Black, weirdly enough, endorsed Justin Trudeau in 2015.
Really?
Which I think is about as, that tells you all you need to know about whether Justin Trudeau was going to be a threat to the Canadian establishment.
I broke my streak of not reading any Conrad Black recently because I read his article, Firing Shots at Margaret Wente, who's another one of our bad public figures here. She's kind of like, our Meghan McArdle, but worse.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if she's worse. That's a pretty, the competition's quite Herculean. She's pretty bad. She's pretty bad.
He had an article in the National Post where he kept calling her Peggy.
Right.
And he kept saying, well, Peggy is always taking shots at me, so she must want to get a rise out of me, so I guess I will have to respond
to her.
This
is a feud I didn't know about. I'll have to follow along.
Anyway, in conclusion, there are no good public figures in Canada, and you will give me some exceptions, but they are exceptions that prove the rule. The good public intellectuals are, I guess, Charles Taylor, maybe Marshall McLuhan, and then Red Green, I think.
C.B. McPherson, George Grant, come on.
Marge the Warrior.
You know, a while ago, I actually started putting together a Michael and Us guide to Canadian pundits. I'm not going to share all of it because, I think we have great designs for how it can be used later. But I want to introduce you to a few of the characters that you meet in the Canadian media landscape. Starting with the op-ed dad, probably my personal favorite. The true workhorse of the Canadian media, the op-ed dad, is the pundit haters won't stop abusing, regularly piling on in droves of four or five in his mentions on Twitter.com. The most likely explanation for this is sheer jealousy. The op-ed dad, after all, regularly graces the National Dialogue, the most important public institution of them all, with incandescent insights into the human condition, such as, it's time for the PM to stop playing politics with investor-state dispute mechanism, and federalism, what a concept. Vigorously committed to rational debate, the op-ed dad aims to transcend the petty fetters of ideology by seeking out new and inventive ways to treat politics like sports commentary and calling out extremists on right and left, but mostly the latter. The op-ed dad once gifted his son a framed reprint of the British North America Act and counts an A-track recording of the collected wartime speeches of Winston Churchill among his most treasured possessions.
You know what? I think I'm just jealous that I don't get invited to write for newspapers. I mean, look at me. I co-host the Michael and Us podcast.
Next up is another great figure in the Canadian media landscape, the market hipster. What if bow tie spinning pro-loathic conservatism could be punk rock? It's an age-old question pondered by philosophes since the day Edmund Burke first went viral by calling out decadent Parisian revolutionaries in the world's longest Yelp complaint. And it's one to which history has offered a provisional answer in the form of the market hipster. Invariably employed in the media in some form or another, she or he mostly has the same opinions and tastes as your Gen X conservative uncle, but peppers conversations with trend-humping bon mots about disruption that they overheard at the vape store. The market hipster is tolerant of all lifestyles, provided they conform to the designated opinions and affectations acceptable in roughly three Toronto neighborhoods where their friends and family live. The market hipster knows that raising the minimum wage will hurt the very people it was supposed to help, and understands that the punkest thing you can be is an upper-middle-class mediophile who loves capitalism and listens to Drake on Spotify.
I met a few of those when we worked at the Varsity.
Okay, one more. We're not going to introduce the whole cast today. This is one I call the leftish. Working title, but anyone familiar with the Canadian media landscape is going to have a few names come to mind. Perhaps because he's kept awake at night by the demons of some brief campus flirtation with Trotskyism in the 1960s, or perhaps out of sheer opportunism, the leftish is psychologically wired to have only one opinion. That something he calls the left has lost its way and is in a very sorry state. An opinion he has written up quite literally thousands of times, always in the same tone of cantankerous get-off-my-lawn indignation, masquerading as genuine moral outrage. As the beloved pre-9/11 rom-com taught us, some people never got over Vietnam or the night their band opened for Nirvana. By the same token, the leftish never quite got over 2003, a mind prison in which he is permanently entrapped yet simultaneously trying to re-enter with every insipid column about why the Canadian and international lefts should just get behind whatever the US State Department is doing that week, just like the famously pro-war leftists of yore. The leftish genuinely believes his mediocre prose are some modern equivalent of Jonathan Swift crossed with 30s George Orwell, but his colleagues are too polite to disabuse him of the notion. I'm proud of these. I think they're good.
Yeah.
There's more of them too, yeah, but we'll save them. We have to do something with this later.
But don't worry, folks. The Michael and Us podcast is here. Sometimes I feel like I'm holding this whole country on my shoulders. It's like when I die, and then also, I guess, when you die, what will be left?
Yes, Michael and Us is really the atlas of Canada, holding up the whole country on its broad back. Anyway, we'll be back to roast some more pundits next week. Thanks for being a Patreon subscriber. I feel like I'm remembering to say it more often now, but please give us a 5-star rating so the algorithms let more people discover the show. And we'll see you next week.
Now watch this drive.
Good day. And you got it.